Julian Bond has been on the cutting edge of social change since he was a college student leading sit-in demonstrations in Atlanta in 1960. He faced jail for his activism, spent 20 years as a Georgia lawmaker, and at 28 was nominated to run for Vice President of the United States. He's now a writer and college lecturer and national chairman of the NAACP. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, Julian Bond with a frank talk about race in America.
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine.
Julian Bond was born in Nashville in 1940. He came of age during the 1960s while a student at Morehouse College. He was active in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In 1965, he was elected to the Georgia House of Delegates. He left politics in 1986 after losing a congressional race to fellow civil rights veteran John Lewis. Julian Bond is my guest today on With Good Reason. Your great-grandmother was a slave. Tell me about her and how you came to have the name Bond.
I never knew my grandparents on either side. And on my mother's side, my great-grandmother was a slave. On my father's side, his father, my grandfather, was a slave, and his mother was a slave.
Your grandfather was a slave?
Yes, my grandfather was a slave.
I didn't know that.
He was born in 1863, so he was a slave for 2 years. His mother was a slave. She'd been given away as a wedding present to a young girl, and when the bride became pregnant, the husband exercised his right to take his wife's slave as his mistress. And that produced two children, one of them my grandfather, the other his brother.
And who was that husband?
His name was Bond. He was Preston Bond. He was a Methodist minister. Many, many years later, after my grandfather had gone to college, had gotten an education, had become a minister, become a professional man, he went back to the place where he and his mother and brother had lived and visited his former owner. And the people were very nice to him, invited him to spend the night at the home, ate at their table with them. And the next day, he's driving my grandfather to the rail station in a trap, in a buggy. And he turns to my grandfather and he's, "James, you look sad. Did you find what you came for?" And he said, "Yes, I did." He said, "What was it?" He said, "I came looking for my father, and it's you." And they never spoke again. Never, never spoke again. But, you know, this question of race in America is such a complex, complicated, and heavily weighted subject. And it's difficult for us to get away from it or to think about it in any kind of single way because it is so complex and complicated.
Tell me about your schooling. You first went to public schools.
Mm-hmm. I grew up first in Fort Valley, Georgia, and immediately went to a private school. But then the family moved to Lincoln University, Pennsylvania, and I went to rural one-room country schools. My parents decided that my older sister and I ought to go to private school. She went to the Cambridge School in Weston, Massachusetts, and I went to the George School in Newtown, Pennsylvania, and got really a superior education, I think, because it was, on the one hand, it was a Quaker school. It had a long history, a long tradition of educational achievement, and just a wonderful place to go to high school. And again, it was integrated. I was one of two black students. And the year I graduated from high school, which is 1957, my father took the job of dean of the School of Education at Atlanta University. And this meant that we're moving from Pennsylvania to Georgia. Now, we had previously moved from rural Georgia to Pennsylvania, but I had been only 5 years old. What did I know? By the time I'm 17 and 57 and we're moving back, I know that the South is an awful place, that lynchings occur every minute, that white people beat you up on the street. So I was terrified to go back there. I had been reading the black newspapers, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Afro-American that had national circulations, and they're all full of these atrocities, Southern atrocities.
Wait, did you ever tell your parents you were afraid?
My mother told me that I needed a suit to go to college in, and I said, "Mama, you go buy it." I said, "They won't hurt you. You're a woman." So she did. She went downtown to Rich's department store and bought me a suit, the only suit I've ever bought without trying one on.
In Atlanta.
And but I quickly found out that you could easily move around Atlanta, at least, with no harassment. It was an oasis in the middle of an awful, awful desert called Georgia, but it was a very pleasant place to live.
How did you first become active in the civil rights movement?
I was sitting in a cafe, and an older student, a man I knew as a football player, approached me with a newspaper, and the newspaper headline said, Greensboro students sit in for third day, and it told how black college students at North Carolina A&T College in Greensboro, North Carolina, for the third day in a row had sat in at the local lunch counter and described how they did it, how they behaved, and so on and so on. And he said, have you seen this? I said, sure. He said, what do you think about it? I said, it's great. He said, don't you think it ought to happen here in Atlanta? I said, I know somebody will do it here in Atlanta. He said, don't you think we ought to do it here? And I said, ooh, what do you mean we? And he had a compelling personality. And he said, you take this side of the cafe, I'll take the other side, and we'll make it happen. And over the next several days, we gathered more and more and more and more people. And then by that time, March had come, and we began Atlanta's first sit-in demonstrations. That's how I got in.
Where'd you go?
I took a group to Atlanta City Hall, which had a cafeteria in the basement. I felt extremely nervous, and I saw the black women who worked behind the steam tables, and they were extremely nervous.
Had you warned them?
No. But they knew what was happening, and they were both frightened and proud. Frightened that this thing was happening, police were going to come. They knew that was, you know, police were going to come. And happy and proud that this thing they'd been reading about happening in North Carolina and in Tennessee had all of a sudden come to Georgia. Here it is, right here.
Didn't it embolden you to realize you were doing it in part for them?
Oh, yes. But it first of all, emboldened us to know that we were joining these other young people in other parts of the South, the Upper South chiefly, who had done this same thing. That we were joining what we didn't realize then was a movement. We weren't the only ones. We were joining others who'd done it, and the others were just like us. Young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, people who had gone to segregated grade school, segregated high school, now were going to segregated public and private colleges, interested in a wide variety of career choices, but we're all doing the same thing, and it was just a fabulous thing.
Remind me of why you all had to do this, that you couldn't sit with white people or be served with white people, or you couldn't go at all.
It was against the law in Georgia for black and white people to eat at a restaurant. It was against the law for black and white people to sit together in any public place.
But you could go to that same restaurant when there weren't white people there?
No. I could go to that restaurant and get something to take out and eat someplace else. If I went to Woolworths in downtown Atlanta, I could go to the end of the counter, order a sandwich, stand and wait for it to be made, given to me, paid for it, take it outside and eat it. But I couldn't sit down and eat it right there.
So what happened in this City Hall cafeteria?
The white woman who's the cashier, whom I later learned was the manager, said, I'm awfully sorry. She said, this is for City Hall employees only. And I said, you got a big sign outside that says City Hall cafeteria, the public is welcome. She said, we don't mean it. I said, we'll stay here until you do. And she called the police, and the police came and arrested us and took us away.
How did they treat you?
Very kindly. I mean, Atlanta had a reputation as being this racial oasis in the middle of the desert of Georgia. So nothing untoward happened, no brutality, nothing. And later that day, black business people in Atlanta put up bond for us, property bonds for us, and we got out.
How did you go from that to becoming part of what we call SNCC?
The SNCC is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. A short while after this Atlanta arrest, we got a letter signed by Martin Luther King and someone named Ella Baker, whom we later found out a great deal about but didn't know who she was. And the letter invited us to come to a meeting of other student sit-in groups in Raleigh, North Carolina on Easter weekend 1960. And so we borrowed some money and a car from adults in Atlanta, and we drove up to Raleigh and found hundreds of other people just like us. And we began thinking then that we're part of a movement.
Wasn't there a time when you didn't have that much admiration for Martin Luther King?
Well, my organization believed in a kind of bottom-up movement. And Dr. King's organization believed in a top-down movement. And the modus operandi of King was to come to a place like Birmingham, to have a series of demonstrations over a short period of time, to win and to move on. our strategy was almost the opposite. We were often contemptuous of the way in which King was perceived by many people as the leader who's coming to town to solve all these problems. And so we resented this deification of King. We used to call him the Lord. We used to say, here come the Lord, here come the Lord, here come the Lord. And we were young, too, and we had a right to be critical and cynical about him, and we were.
Both of you took national heat for opposing the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Conscientious objection. Where did that come from in you?
Some of it came from my years at the George School, this Quaker school in Pennsylvania, and this exposure to Quakerism and to pacifism and to nonviolence, which is something I'd never thought about a great deal until years later when I got in the civil rights movement and we began practicing nonviolence at the lunch counters. And then by 1965, as the war in Vietnam is just heating up, as the death toll is slowly starting to mount, as more and more Americans are saying, you know, something wrong here.
Were you drafted?
No. I was declared 4Y, which means physically, mentally, or morally unfit for military service, not to be called except in case of national emergency, because I was arrested in a sit-in demonstration. They declared me unfit for service.
How did your objection to the Vietnam War get you in so much trouble with the Georgia legislature?
A young man I knew named Sammy Young, who had become ill in the Navy and had lost one of his kidneys, and therefore had to go to the bathroom more than most people, had tried to go to a white-only gas station in his hometown of Tuskegee, Alabama, and been shot in the back and killed. And the irony of this guy losing his life after losing his kidney in service to his country was just too much. And so a lot of anti-war sentiment and SNCC bubbled to the top, and it came out in a statement which I endorsed, which was extremely critical of the war in Vietnam, and said that there ought to be alternatives to fighting in the war, and those alternatives ought to include fighting for civil rights here at home. And when I presented myself in January to take my seat, they objected to my being seated, and they threw me out and declared my seat vacant. And
did that hurt you?
Oh, man. I had been elected. I had raised money. I had knocked on doors. I'd kissed babies. I'd made speeches. I'd done all the things you have to do to win a public office. And I won the public office, overwhelmingly won the public office. And now these people are telling me that the people who elected me had made some mistake. I was so angry. But they called a new election. I ran in that election. I won that election. And they threw me out again. And I filed a lawsuit. We had a hearing before a three-judge panel, federal panel in Atlanta, and I lost there 2-1. We appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and in the fall of that year, I won 9-0 in the Supreme Court. And the following January, 67 by now, I took my seat, and I served in the lower house and in the Senate for the next 20 years.
You were a young pup in 1968 at the tumultuous Democratic Convention in Chicago, when you got a nomination for Vice President of the United States. How old were you then?
I was 28. I think it was only Senator Muskie and myself. And, of course, I withdrew before a vote was cast because I was constitutionally too young to take this job. You have to be 35.
Isn't it ironic that you ended up being chairman of the NAACP?
It is extremely ironic because when I was active with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in my early 20s, we had many, many quarrels with the NAACP. We thought it was too large and bulky. It just didn't have the edge that we as 20-year-olds thought a movement ought to have. And in some ways, many of those criticisms could be made against the NAACP today. So for me to be the chairman of the board of this organization that I once scorned as being slow and backward and so on is the height of irony. But I'll tell you something. In 1960, there was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Congress of Racial Equality, the NAACP, the Urban League. Today, only the NAACP exists as a nationwide organization. It is the largest collection of grassroots people working for civil rights in this country, and it is that survival that attracted me to it.
You know, I heard a radio news report not long ago talking about worries about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. Do you worry sometimes that white Americans are going to wash their hands of this or try to purge themselves and say, Can we move on?
I'm not worried that they're going to do that. I'm worried that they're doing that now. Most white Americans think that problems of race have disappeared, that racial discrimination doesn't exist, that educational equality has arrived right now, even as our schools are becoming more, not less, segregated all across the country. So there's a real disconnect between reality and perception among a large part of the white population. And of course, the support of that population is absolutely necessary if you're going to move forward. And if you can't convince them there's a problem, then you have trouble convincing them to take up solutions.
For one thing, you have to grant them some things and debate them on other points.
Oh, indeed so.
What do you grant?
I grant that I'm 63 years old. In the years of my life, I have seen enormous change occur in the United States, particularly in the South, where I spent most of my life. The American South today is a radically different place than it was when I was a college student. And unlike my students I teach today, people of my age and generation had almost no options for employment outside of the segregated world. All that's changed. All of that has changed, and we're never, ever going back. But much of the prejudice which allowed that to happen still remains. I mean, if you look again at public opinion data, it's fairly evident that a majority of white people think that black Americans are less than equal human beings. They're less patriotic, they think. They're less industrious, and they're less desirable as a neighbor, a coworker, and a friend. How do you make progress toward equality if a majority believes that the population you're talking about isn't worthy of equality?
Where are you in affirmative action? Is it something you think we can ever get rid of?
You know, it's interesting. When in the last Supreme Court decision from Maryland about this, Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice O'Connor, said that she thought 25 years might be a good limitation. Now, we've had it for about 35 years. So she's saying 60 years will be enough from beginning to the end. But interestingly, in her book she recently wrote about her life, she asked the rhetorical question, when will we know that women have equality in the United States? And she answered by saying, we'll know when women have achieved their proper representation, equal to their numbers in the population, in every field of American life. Why isn't that a good standard for racial minorities? I think it is, and I think she ought to rethink this. And I think we'll know when we can get rid of affirmative action, when racial minorities are spread throughout American life in equal proportion to their numbers in the population.
So what do you say to people who say, fine, in principle, I embrace that, but I do not want my child bumped out of an opportunity for advancement by your child based on skin color?
Nobody's guaranteed any success in life. You have to struggle and fight for it, try to improve yourself as best you can. And I'd say if you think about college admissions, there are only so many places, and universities have to decide who's going to fill those places. And they do so taking into account a wide variety of things about children, high school graduates. And one of them, only one of them, is race. And when they consider race, they're saying, what makes up a good student body? What makes up a good class of 2007? I think so many men, so many women, so many athletes, so many scientists, so many moody, mystical children, so many brusque, aggressive children, and so many blacks, and so many whites. And why can't we say, we want a college class that looks like America, and race is a big consideration in America? I don't understand why this is objectionable at all.
These people say, yeah, but you got to have high SATs. You got to have straight A's in high school.
No, you don't. If the University of Virginia, where I teach, chose students by SAT scores alone, the majority of the students at the University of Virginia would come from Northern Virginia, and a majority of the out-of-state students would come from the New England states, because those are the areas of the country where SAT scores are the highest. But the University of Virginia doesn't pick them like that. It picks them based on a variety of aspects of their personality, of their academic achievement, of their interest, of a wide variety of things, because it wants well-rounded people. It doesn't want grinds who do nothing but study. There's no school in the country that picks people based on their SAT scores alone.
Another thing that bugs a lot of white people is the use of the term racist.
Well, it probably is used too much by too many people, but it is an apt description of a certain kind of attitude. And you hear Trent Lott saying he wishes that Strom Thurmond had been president. I mean, Strom Thurmond ran for president as a racist. Had he been president, he would have a racist administration. So what can you call Trent Lott except someone who's fondly wishing for the days when racists held public power in the United States? I mean, it's inescapable. That's what he's doing.
Has the definition of racism changed, evolved?
No, I don't think it's simply it's the belief that race A is superior to race B. That's it. That's what a racist believes.
What about Howard Dean saying he was hoping he could win over the hearts and votes of Southerners with Confederate flags in their pickup trucks?
You know, I thought that was an entirely legitimate statement to make and could not see why it seemed so objectionable to some people. If you're going to be successful in politics in this country, you got to get a majority of the votes, although we know that doesn't always work. But you have to get a majority of the votes, and there are people with Confederate flags on their bumper stickers that candidates like Howard Dean ought to be appealing to. They have interest. They're worried about the economy. And we can't cede them to other people. Democrats, if they're going to win, have to go after these people and appeal to them and get their votes.
What about the Confederate flag in general?
Generally, the Confederate flag ought not fly on public policy. You know, the United States fought the Confederacy, and we won. We beat them. We quashed them. We squashed them. The Confederate flag is the only flag of a defeated army that flies on public property anywhere in the United States. You don't see Italian flags or German flags flying across the United States on public property. You see them in front of their embassies, and that's where they ought to be.
So the people who fly them say, look, this is not a slam on you. It is not a slam on blacks. This really just embodies the cultural heritage from our ancestors. Give us that.
If that's the case, it's the flag of a nation that existed for 4 years. So are you telling me that the whole scope of Southern history is encapsulated by these 4 years and a war in which you lost and a war fought over whether or not some people can own other people? Is that Southern history? Is that Southern heritage? I like to think it's much better than that. I'm a Southerner. I like the part of the country I'm from and where I grew up and where I spent most of my life. But that's not what it's all about. It's about something more than that. It's about food. It's about culture. It's about religion. It's about friendliness. It's about warmth. It's not just about those 4 years. Those 4 years are important. And because they're important, the flag of those 4 years ought to be kept in museums. But it ought not fly from public property. If you want it in the back of your pickup truck, go right ahead. If you want it in your T-shirt, go right ahead. If you want it tattooed on your back, go right ahead. But don't fly it from public property.
How do you feel about self-segregation?
I walk into the cafeteria at the University of Virginia, and I say, why are all the white students sitting together? What is it with these kids? Don't they know that they should mix with people not like themselves? Why are they all huddling together? I look at table after table after table after table of white kids. And no wonder that you see one or two tables of black kids, because where else are they going to sit? Now, of course, when I say this to my class, they say, oh, that's not what's happening. It's the black people sitting together. Well, of course, it's not just the black people. It's everybody self-segregating. But somehow or another, when minorities do it, it's thought of as some kind of enormous evil that isn't present when white students do it. I think there's a natural tendency of people to find people like themselves. And if you're a minority, which means that you're outnumbered and you're set off from the larger group, there are times when you want to be by yourself. If you're a girl, you don't want to answer questions, how do you do your hair? How'd you get your hair like that? And, you know, I've asked students in my classes, how many of you have been asked questions about your hair? And every black girl in the class raises her hand. Now, these are not mean-spirited questions. These are not. But after a while, you get tired of being a representative of your race. You just want to be yourself. And after a while, you want to be with people who went to school with you, have your same experiences. That doesn't mean and should not mean that you cut yourself off from intercourse with the wider variety of people in a setting like UVA, because that's one reason why you ought to be here. If you don't want that experience, you should go to Hampton or to Virginia Union or some black college. But you come here because of what the variety UVA has to offer, and if you don't take advantage of it, you're hurting yourself.
There was an incident not long ago at the University of Virginia where a hospital administrator used the N-word and said, you know, the Redskins is an offensive name, and it is as offensive to American Indians as the N-word, and she used it, is to African Americans. Any thoughts on what happened there?
The N-word is an offensive word almost always, but I use it in class. I begin every semester by saying, I'm going to say things that are offensive to some people, and if you're the kind of person who's going to be offended, then you ought to leave class right now. This is not the place for you. So you've been warned when you come in there that I'm going to say things that might be offensive to you or to the person sitting next to you. And I use it when I'm quoting someone who used this word in saying something that advances the story I'm telling. And as my understanding of this incident, that was a proper context in which this word could be used.
You know, we see increasingly demographic changes in the U.S. population that show other minority groups becoming more numerous. Does that worry you about the ability to make strides in the civil rights category if you think the majority of Americans are going, shoo, other minorities and their issues are going to supplant the old ones?
No, because African Americans for years are going to be the largest racial minority in the United States. Hispanics can be of any race. So African Americans are the largest racial minority in the United States today, and we will be for years and years to come. But the addition of these new minorities who are ethnic or national rather than racial, but also racial as well because there are black Hispanics, that's a welcome sign because it means that the army is getting larger and more soldiers are joining the fight.
Are you an optimistic guy?
I am an optimistic guy. I believe things are going to get better because I've seen them get better over my lifetime, and I believe they'll do so in the future. I don't think they'll do so at the rate of speed I want to see, but they'll do it. They'll do it.
Julian Bond, thank you so much for sharing your insights today and With Good Reason.
Thank you for having me.
Children, you better run.
Run when God says.
Somebody's calling you, you better run.
Run when I say.
Somebody's calling you.
Julian Bond is a writer and professor at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and at American University in Washington, D.C. He's national chairman of the NAACP.
Somebody's calling you, you better run.
What I say.
Somebody's calling you, you better run.
You're listening to With Good Reason. Our associate producers are Nancy King and Elliot Majerzyk. Andrew Wyndham is our executive producer. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. This program featured music by the Paschal Brothers of Tidewater, Virginia, and by the Freedom Singers. This program has been produced for this station by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5098 or email us at withgoodreason@virginia.edu. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
My time ain't long.